Hello, once again, I'm James White, and this is another episode of the Solution Series, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Corey Lynn. Corey, always great to be here with you.
Great to be here too.
It is indeed. And folks, we are delighted. This month, February, is going to be more sort of a financial type of your personal assets series. And both the interviews this month are going to be sort of on that topic. And we're delighted today to be joined by Ann Christensen. And let me give Ann a brief introduction. Ann has 35 years of experience in the personal trust arena. Most of that time was at a variety of bank-run and independent trust companies. In 2012, she had the opportunity to leave corporate America and start her own private fiduciary business, understanding that there are a lot of individuals who do not want to work with financial institutions, me included. Christensen Consulting offers a personalized relationship-based consulting approach to assist individuals and families while they are developing their estate plans and advisory team. And we want to point out that she's not an attorney. She's not an investment manager. She's not a tax person. She's not a financial planner. But she does do estate planning documents, and they need to be reviewed and updated. And she needs to make an honest assessment of your family dynamics to have clarity about your organization and your assets. And tangible assets, of course, are important, and we're going to talk about that as well. Ann Christensen, thanks so much for being here today on the Solution Series.
My pleasure. I look forward to it.
Indeed. We're glad to have you here. Corey, I know that this is one of the things that we've talked about. This is a topic, I think, that really is near and dear to your heart. So if you want to go ahead and kick off, if you have any questions you want to start off with, Ann, go right ahead.
Sure. So I think a great thing to start out. So we're going to talk about trusts and wills and estates and other important documents for people. I think also living trusts would be a question as well. You know, it's important for the now, for people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, I would assume, not just people, you know. So I think maybe it would be good if you were to just explain a will, a trust, a living trust, and kind of what the difference is between them.
Sure. I think that's a perfect place to start. So a will is a legal contract that takes effect when the individual who created the will passes away. So it has nothing to do with helping them during their lifetime. And what it does is it sets out to whomever is named as the executor or the personal representative how they want their net estate to be distributed to individuals, to organizations, to a combination thereof. A trust, you can create a trust during your lifetime, which is the living trust. You can also create a trust in your will, which is called a testamentary trust. The living trust created during your lifetime typically is what's called a revocable or revocable trust, meaning that the grantor, the individual who created the document, can make changes as long as he or she is competent and alive. If and when the individual becomes medically declared unable to manage their affairs, then that trust automatically becomes irrevocable. There are some exceptions, but as a general rule, irrevocable, meaning that the next trustee in line cannot change how the assets are distributed, either during the remaining life of the grantor or at their death. So it makes sure that what the grantor's wishes were are never changed, which is important.
So can I just ask real quick, when you say the other, how did you phrase that? Was it the other trustee? Okay. Yeah. So is that, in other words, when you're setting up the living trust, you would set someone as the beneficiary or the trustee? If something were to happen to you, then they would take over?
Yeah, but their beneficiary and trustee can be two different things, Corey.
Okay.
So when I set up the Ann Christensen Trust, I am called the grantor, the one creating the trust. And I also, again, the majority of the times, I name myself as trustee. The document will say if I'm unable to manage my affairs or don't want to, then I name my husband, Jay Badger, to take over. If Jay Badger's unable to, then, you know, then you go down either naming additional individuals or a financial institution to step in as the trustee.
Okay, got it.
Can I interject? Where does the durable power of attorney or a power of attorney fit into here? Is that something that is in this whole mix as well?
It is not in the trust document, but it is a separate document that we should talk about at least briefly. So we can talk either about it now, Jim, if you want to.
Go right ahead. I'm sorry to take you off your point. Please forgive me. Go right ahead.
No, that's okay. So in addition to needing to name multiple trustees in the trust agreement, you also need to name the individuals or organizations that you want to have eventually get whatever is left at your death and after final expenses have been paid. Right. So a beneficiary can be a trustee. I think there are some difficult issues that get presented with that scenario, but they typically are two separate entities or people.
Okay.
In a testamentary trust that comes at the time of my death would be included in my will. It would not have been done in a revocable trust during my lifetime. And again, you need the same decisions about who will be my personal representative, who will then manage my estate, wrap up the final bills, collect the assets, and then they will distribute that trust according to the beneficiaries named in that document. And that is an irrevocable document that will never be able to be changed.
Okay, so the last one you just mentioned, you said is a trust that falls under your will.
Right, testament.
Did I understand that correctly?
That's correct.
Okay.
And if you think about it, it's called a testamentary trust because it's included in your last will and testament.
Got it. So what types of assets would someone put in a living trust? And one of the questions I have around this is, you know, you've got obviously personal assets, there's property, there's bank accounts, and then a lot of people, especially nowadays, either, you know, work from home, they have their own businesses. And so I wonder how the businesses, you know, when something happens to someone and that business gets dissolved, then the assets from it, is that something that should work into a trust, for example?
Kind of a
lot of questions there.
Well, that's okay. So let's start at the top of the list. What can go into a trust?
Okay.
And let me back up a couple of more steps. When you create a trust, you need to also then retitle whatever assets you are putting under the umbrella of the trust. So if I have a brokerage account and it was in my name individually, I created a trust and I want it to be under the umbrella of that trust document, I need to go back to the brokerage house and have them change it from Ann Christensen to the Ann Christensen Revocable Trust dated January 25th, 2023. If you don't make that change in ownership, then at your death, the trust will be deemed to not own anything and everything will go by your will.
Okay.
So what can go into trusts? You can put brokerage accounts, investment accounts. You can put book entry accounts through ComputerShare where you have stock. You can put privately held stock into it. You can put bank accounts of any kind.
Intellectual property?
Intellectual property can go in. That's one that a lot of people, from my experience, it's not in as much favor, Jim, as it used to be, but it's a great way to shield it and keep it private if you put it in the trust. Things that you would not put in the trust, which I think are just as important as what you would put in, is typically you would not want to put a retirement or a tax deferred account into the trust. So if I have an IRA and I make the beneficiary my trust, there are some adverse tax consequences to doing it that way, because the benefit of a tax deferred account is you can give that to my son and have that pay out incrementally over an actuarial time frame. If the trust is the beneficiary, it collapses that time frame. You have to recognize all of that income, and it creates an unnecessary tax situation.
So let me break it down a little bit simpler. Why a trust is designed to just protect your assets against, I mean, just see government seizure, tax liability, takeover from somebody, third party. I mean, what would essentially, what is a trust designed to do, just in layman's terms?
So two things. A trust is designed where at your incapacity or death, it is a private transaction that is only known to the people who step in as trustee, as opposed to a will. When you die, and at least in the state of New Mexico, my will is filed with the court. The inventory of my assets is filed with the court, and it becomes public record.
Wow, is that right?
Yep. Mm. Now, I don't know if all states are that way.
That seems a little bit odd.
It's odd, but it is the reality. And a lot of people don't realize that. Some people don't care. For some people, privacy is not an issue. Right. The more and more people with whom I work, privacy becomes extremely important. Right. They don't want the neighbor down the street to know how much money they had. It's none of their business. Right. So that is the biggest benefit in my mind of a trust. And then there's some additional irrevocable trusts where if you shift low basis, low cost items and survive for 3 years from the time that you created the trust, then that money is passed out of your estate. So I think there are probably more benefits than not for most people to take the time and energy to do the trust during your life. So it's in place. Everybody is named who takes over for your finances and handling the distribution. And it's private. It's not public. So
when you talk about some of the assets that you put into it, such as stocks or bank accounts, what type of documentation then is required, because you're going to have to ultimately get that information to the various institutions so that they know, so that should something happen to you, then the beneficiary doesn't have to deal with courts or nonsense, right?
Correct. And great question. So at the time that the trust document is created, there is typically also a secondary document that's called a certification of trust, or COT. That is a distilled version of the trust document that will tell the financial institutions who the grantor was, when it was dated, who the trustee is, what the tax ID number is, and what the powers of the trustee are. But it excludes who the beneficiaries are. You don't want to give that whole document that lists who you are benefiting at your death to a bank, or I wouldn't, to a brokerage firm. It's none of their business. So the certification of trust takes out any of the beneficiary information and just gives the legal department of the financial institution proof that it's a valid trust document, and the right people are coming to them to change the name on the account.
Okay.
Sometimes you have to be very forceful when you go to these financial institutions, because they feel they have a right to the entire document, but then you push them back. They don't need that.
Did you say they do need to know who the trustees would be, though?
Yes.
Okay. So like grantor trustee.
And what that does, Corey, is if you're a bank and I come to you saying I want to put it into the Ann Christensen Trust, the bank wants some validation or confirmation that I have the right to do that as a trustee.
Right.
So that certificate of trust has a paragraph that says Ann Christensen is the trustee.
So they never need to know who the beneficiaries are because the trustee would ultimately handle that.
That's right. They're not responsible for doing anything other than getting the name changed and perhaps changing the taxpayer ID number.
Okay. What were you going to say, Jim?
Well, I was saying you've heard the term trust fund baby. There's a trust fund baby. That would assume that you can set up a trust that when the child turns a certain age, they start giving payments out to them or something like that. Is that where a trust would be over like a will? A will seems to me like you make an announcement. Okay, you get $1 million and this person gets $1 million and everybody goes their own way. A trust seems like it's something you can set more structured where you can have regular payments and things like that. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. And remember, a will only has an umbrella over assets owned at the time of death in the individual's name.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow, really? Okay, that's an important distinction.
It is an important distinction. And so typically, I firmly believe that everybody should have a will and a financial and a healthcare power of attorney, all documents that are created during your lifetime. The will, if you have a trust, you still need a will because 99% of us with trusts have a bank account in your name individually, just to make things easy. Have a car. I don't like putting cars in trusts because of potential reaching in for lawsuits and things like that. But what you can say in the will is any assets that have been handled by my will, when all of the estate administration is completed, it pours into the trust. Okay. So it allows, again, the beneficiaries to be private, and it allows the trust to be that receptacle for both the trust-held assets and individually held assets.
That's so interesting. I didn't realize
that. That's kind of cool. Yeah, I know. That's really kind of cool. I didn't realize you could kind of do that.
Well, and if you think about the whole concept of pouring over, you know, you're pouring individual assets into another vehicle.
So now, do you recommend people work with an attorney or a consultant or someone, you know, such as yourself when they're planning this, or do you recommend any resources where people can find some good forms and guidance to work from?
Good question. Let me pause for a minute to break down the different pieces. I will say, you can find on the internet legal spots where you can get a will, you can get your powers of attorney, and you can get a trust. I firmly believe, and a lot of this is based on experience that I've had with improperly drafted wills, I believe it makes sense to spend money on a professional estate planning attorney who knows the laws of the state in which you reside and can tailor that document to fit your needs. I've seen too many legal Zoom type things where they just don't have all of the bells and whistles that would be put in by an attorney. I'm not an attorney. I don't draft documents. What I do, and I think it's proven to be extremely helpful, both within my client base and my family, is I can sit down with them, with a client, before they go to the attorney. And I know the people that they're going to need to name, you know, multiple names for trustees. We can talk about the family dynamics, which can be really hard for a lot of people. There are a lot of very private and painful personal situations. So I can help get it out on the table and help them figure out what they want to do. You know, There are, just to give one example, if I may, there are many families where alcoholism is a problem. Mm-hmm. And it's still, I find, to be a very private matter. It's not talked about openly. And there are situations where a couple have two children, one is an alcoholic and one is not. I think the social mores are you have to leave everything equally to your children. But I have the conversation with people, what if that alcoholic falls off the wagon? You know, do you want to protect that money in that event? Or do you want to say, I'll give it to my children 50-50, and if they choose to drink it, then that's their issue.
Right.
Those conversations are expensive to have with an attorney because they typically charge a lot more than a consultant one that I do. And attorneys aren't really there for as much emotional support as some people need, is what I, you know, people want a trusted environment where they can say all of the horrible things they don't want anybody to know, sort of talk it through, and then figure out what they want to do. So when they go to the attorney, they have the majority of the information the attorney needs to plug into the documents.
Right. And along those same lines, I would say I've seen firsthand with selecting an executor,
yep.
You know, that gets tricky. Do you want it to be a friend, a family member? Right. That the dynamics with all that can get really tricky too.
It can. And the other place, Corey, where it becomes very clear that it's difficult is if we can sort of do a sidebar over to the powers of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
There are two powers of attorney, one for finance, which is a durable power of attorney or a statutory attorney. The power of attorney for healthcare, I think typically spouses name one another, and then you name children or siblings.
Right.
But what I see is it can be very difficult for a child who's going through the grieving process of getting ready to lose a parent to have to make decisions with a clear mind.
Right.
And it's something, it can work, but families need to talk through it to make mm-hmm. sure the child understands what the parent wants done. You know, that document codifies what the parent wants.
Right.
Which can be different than what the child wants because the child doesn't want to lose the parent.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And I think too that, you know, it's another thing I've seen firsthand is as people get older, you know, their parents sometimes don't want to talk about, they just don't want to talk about it. They don't want to plan. They don't want to think about a funeral. They don't want to think about much of anything. And so maybe a child brings it up to them. Look, like what are your, you know, desires? What do you want? And then when it happens, it's like a storm trying, you know, during an emotional state, like you're talking about.
Right.
And I was laughing actually with my parents the other night because my mom is more detailed than me. This is where I get my organizational skills from.
No way.
She literally has like everything planned out for after they go, you know, down to, you know, the cemetery, the headstones, she even was writing up their obituaries. I'm like, you can't write your own obituary. That's crazy.
That's crazy.
I'm like, I'm the writer in the family. No.
Yeah.
So yeah. So it is. It's tricky business. One of the questions I have is with copies of documents, like how many copies of these documents do you want to have, and whose hands should they be in?
Good question. So there can only be one original will, and you can make multiple copies of it. A trust, you very often they will do two, maybe three original documents, and then you can make copies of that if you want. You know, where to keep them is becoming a very interesting question. When right. I started out in the business, mid 70s, you know, everybody had a safe deposit box because that's mm-hmm. where you kept all of your original important papers. Well, nowadays with privacy issues and banks becoming stricter and stricter with who can be recognized on bank account or safe deposit boxes, it can be very cumbersome if I've put my original will in a box in my name only, because the bank will want to see the original will in order to know who's the executor of my estate. Well, it's in the box, you know, what do I do?
Right.
So I'm also, though, not a fan of leaving original documents in a home unless you have a fireproof safe. Because, right. you know, if they get burned up and I am at that point medically determined to be unable to manage my affairs, then there is no will. I die intestate is what they call it, because there's no valid will. And then you get the courts involved and it's just, it's a mess.
Right. So do you want the trustees to have a copy of it? Or, I mean, would that be advantageous or no?
I think it would be. I think very often, not always, if you have both a will and a trust, the executor and the trustee tend to be the same person.
Okay.
So they should definitely have both documents. They need to know who the beneficiaries are.
Right.
But a copy is fine as long as somebody knows where the original is.
And so if you suddenly, let's say 5 years go by and you now have some additional land or assets that you want to add, is that just written up as like an amendment to it or addendum to it? And then you have to resubmit that?
No. So, and are you, let's see. So when you do a trust, you don't have to do an inventory, call it, of the assets that are being transferred into the name of the trust.
Okay.
So in part of that evolution is as people age and typically add assets, they don't have to go back and get the trust document updated. They just need to make sure that when they add that second piece of property for a vacation home, that they title it in the name of the trust.
Okay. So I don't remember if we addressed this or not. I want to go back quickly to businesses.
We haven't gotten there.
Okay. Yeah. Because I see a lot of businesses, whether it's an LLC, I don't know. Is it with LLCs and corporations where they will set up a trust and put the company like under the trust?
And I have to be very honest. I don't know that much about the business side of the benefits, the pros and cons of doing it through a trust. My understanding, Corey, is that is usually done through a document that created the business, but I don't want to even opine on it because I just don't have the right information.
Okay.
Can I swing back just for 1 second before we go away from the trust real quick? And we have a lot of ranchers and farmers here in Montana, and you hear the horror stories about a farmer that passes away. And they go to, you know, they will their farm to their children, and the taxes or whatever is so much they have to sell their farm, and then the family farm that's been there for generations goes away because they just can't, you know, they can't handle the burden of that. Is there any way that they can protect themselves from that situation? I know it's a tax situation, but there has to be. Would a trust protect that, or is there anything that a farmer could do or a rancher while they're living to prevent that from happening and having their farm just, you know, just basically absorbed by the IRS?
Yeah. So that scenario can play out either under a trust, Jim, or in just a regular will, because when the person dies, that asset has to be looked at and valued for tax purposes. My recommendation is when you add something like a ranch, or have predominantly real estate assets that aren't may not be generating a large income stream into a trust or a will. You also need to make sure you have cash assets in it, brokerage account, bank account, CDs, treasury bills, so that there are assets available to cover any taxes owing, which would minimize the possibility that they'd have to put it up for sale to pay taxes.
Right on. Okay. So you just mitigate that risk in advance and have assets available in case that scenario comes up. You got a little bit of a cushion. And,
correct.
Right. Okay. Very good. Okay.
Correct.
All right, Corey, go right ahead, Corey. So I didn't mean to jump in there.
Well, one of the things I recently learned about by an attorney, which is something I did, is a POD, the pay on death.
On death.
A simple form that you can submit to your bank on your personal accounts, listing a beneficiary if something happens to you. It's just something like kind of quick and simple to do. And I'm wondering if what you might know about that. They said, you know, of course, I can't use it on a business account, only personal accounts.
Right.
Are there other types of documents like that out there that I'm not aware of, that just other types of documents for protecting, you know, your assets?
So I think where I'm stumbling is I wouldn't say POD protects your assets. It doesn't protect your assets. What POD or TOD, payable on death or transferable on death, does is it allows for a quicker transfer of that asset
from
the owner to the beneficiary. So I have a bank account, it's in my name, I want the money to go to my husband, I would make him the POD on that bank account. That my husband would only have to go into the bank with my death certificate, show it to the banker, that they would then go see POD is payable to him, they would give him that access to that money right away.
Right.
If you don't do the POD, then it can take a little bit longer at times to get access to that money to the beneficiary, just because of paperwork.
Right. So in other words, if you had the trust and the trustee would go in and deal with the bank, and to get that money through to the beneficiary, it could take a little longer.
That's exactly right.
Okay, so it could be advantageous, especially if people are tight on money, and if someone does pass and they need it for funeral planning, for example.
Exactly. Or just plain living expenses.
Right.
You know, and I am a fan of both parties in a marriage having a bank account in their name, either jointly or at least in their name, and make sure there's always money in there for precisely that reason. So when I die, my husband has access to money in the bank account in his name.
Right.
I will say, though, my caveat with the PODs is, and I've seen some people do this, where they have attached PODs to all of their assets. So you can do a transfer of death on death deed for real estate. You can do PODs for bank accounts. But what you have to be careful for is if there is going to be some sort of an estate, you need to provide the executor with a pot of money to pay expenses.
Right.
I have been in one situation where that happened, and I needed to open a probate estate, and I had to front my own money. Mm. So, you know, it may not be right for the client, but you have to take into consideration the person that you're putting in the position of having the legal responsibility to collect any other assets and file final tax returns, pay final bills. And if you've given all your money away through a POD, that person has nothing to do but use their own money, or say, hey, there is no money.
Right. What were you going to say, James?
I was going to say there, pardon me, the age that you can, that I imagine, like all other legal documents, is there, you probably have to be 18 to engage in a legal document. Yeah. So is there anything that the parents can do for their children preliminarily for that? Is there any type or do you just have to wait till you're 18 to get a trust and a will? And, or is there anything that parents can do with their children beforehand to protect it? And I know children don't have a lot of assets typically, so maybe it's not necessary, but at what age should you start, you know, should you have your children start thinking about these type of things? Is it 18 is probably a little young? I don't know.
18 for most of us is young.
Right.
Now, trust fund babies who may have accumulated, who may be given a trust account or a pot of money when they turn 18, they should get to an estate planning attorney and get a document done. You know, it's kind of gallows humor, but in the business, it's like you want to make sure you get your estate planning documents done before you're declared incompetent. And we, you know, we don't know when that's going to happen. So
you should see some of my mail. People think I'm already that already, but anyway, that's another story.
Yeah, and they would like to make all of us incompetent right now. So,
indeed, right? Indeed.
You know, so parents can set up custodial accounts for their minor children. You can do that at a bank account, and I believe usually when the child reaches whatever the majority is in that state, then that money is theirs. You know, I think typically people start to do wills and trusts when they have a job, start to accumulate retirement or tax deferred accounts, maybe acquire a condo or something, when they start to have assets that should be protected. It's tough, Jim, because 18-year-olds, 25-year-olds, even 55-year-olds aren't necessarily focused in on what kind of legal documents they need to protect themselves. But I think parents can do their children a big favor just by sitting down and talking to them. Hey, this is what you need to do at some point in your life. These are the reasons why. This is what you do.
You know, as far as financial instruments go, life insurance, I'm sure, has to fit in to that mix somewhere, because that is, we talked before about having some funds available so you don't have to sell the ranch. If you had a life insurance policy in place, that would offset a lot of those costs. Is that something that you put in the matrix of your planning? Please, can you get a comment on that?
Yeah, you can do that. And in that case, you can name the trust or the estate, if you don't have a trust, as the beneficiary, so that it goes right to the estate. You can name children and have the money pay out at your death right to them if you want them to have some money available. But life insurance is a great one.
Now, I have a question on, you probably covered this a little bit, but just so I have clarity, let's say you have a living trust and something happens to you, maybe you become physically disabled and you can't work, or you need help and you want your beneficiary to have like access to certain things. But you haven't technically died, you know, does that fall into this at all? Or.
So that's one of the benefits of a trust is the trust allows for a smoother transition from me under my trust to me when I become incapacitated. In this case, then the successor trustee who steps in can then continue to use the trust funds for my benefit. And if my trust document allows it, can also take funds for a beneficiary.
Okay.
While I'm alive, as long, you know, if the document can be structured to say, while Anne is incapacitated, all of her bills are to be covered. And if her son is in school, money can also be used to cover her son's college tuition or graduate work.
Okay.
medical expenses. But there has to be a provision within the trust document that gives the successor trustee the ability to do that.
Okay.
Another thing just along that line, Corey, is annual gifting to charities is important to a lot of people. The same thing can be done in the trust document. In the trust document, it can say, even when Anne is incapacitated, you may use funds to continue her pattern of gifting that she's done over the years. So that can be gifting to charities. It can also be the annual exclusion gift, exemption gift, that anybody can give $16,000 a year to anybody else without any tax consequences.
Is it $16,000?
It was last year. I haven't checked to see what it is this year.
Gosh, I remember years ago talking about this, and it was like, I always thought it was parents can gift their children up to $10,000 a year, but you're saying it's $16,000 now, and it doesn't even have to be the children. It can be gifting to anyone?
Anybody at all.
How did I miss that one?
And there are a lot of families where that they have the wealth to be able to do that. And if that is cut off because of an incapacity, that can provide financial hardships for the people that have gotten used to having that additional money every year.
Right. And now the person who receives it doesn't have to pay taxes on it, correct?
Correct. The person gifting or getting, there's no tax consequence either way.
Right. Okay. Now, one of the bullet points you had mentioned was you said estate planning documents are not static. They need to be reviewed and updated as your life changes.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So, divorce. You created a joint trust while you were married and you're now getting divorced. Those documents should be negated, and each person after the divorce is finalized should create their own estate planning documents. If you have a second marriage and you both have children from a previous marriage, you need to think about how you want the joint second marriage assets to be held and how you want them distributed at the death of each individual. If a child develops some sort of medical illness where that child is now able to get SSI, Social Security insurance, because of a disability.
Right.
You want to make sure that the trust document creates a separate trust to protect that child's portion of the inheritance so that they can continue to get the government benefit. Because they can't, if they get a large amount of money in their name, then the government disability goes away. I always say marriage or divorce, children, adoption, additional children or children passing away. Or if how you want to leave your money changes, some people with whom I work feel that at some point they've given their children enough money. The children are self-supporting, they have good jobs, and the grantors now want to leave everything to charity. That all has to be incorporated into an amendment for the trust.
So as far as the financial and healthcare powers of attorney, unless you needed to change who you want that to be, those are documents that can pretty much just remain once you get them in place, correct?
Correct. But my caveat to that, Corey, would be you need to make sure that you name 2 to 3 individuals to be, they're called agent. The agent is the person that acts under those documents, because agent 1 and 2 could have died, moved, retired, or not want that job.
Right. So
as long as you have enough people that the odds are pretty good that somebody will be able to take over, then yes, it would not They would not have to be done again. Now, if you move states, you need to talk to an attorney. To some states have very specific language they want to see in these documents. Others don't. So it never hurts when you establish residency somewhere else to just to go and show a local attorney what you have and let them decide if it needs to be updated.
That's a good point.
And then the statutory power of attorney, I think, Jim, you're the one that asked about a durable power of attorney.
Correct. Yes, you're correct.
Both of those are financial. Durable powers of attorneys came along to allow when a person becomes incapacitated that the power of attorney is still in, still a valid document. There was a time along years ago where when somebody became incapacitated, that power of attorney could be questioned. So it just means it goes for the rest of that life. And, you know, one of the things that people don't always remember is power of attorneys die with you. So at your death, the healthcare and the financial power of attorney are no longer valid documents. At that point, either the will takes over or the trustee takes over.
Wow, interesting. This is very interesting. A very interesting interview. So can you give us, Anne, how much does it start for people that, you know, everybody has different levels of financial and different budgets to because it's going to cost some cost up front to get these documents put together properly and whether they're filed or whatever you do. How much would it cost someone to get started? And if they were just starting with, you know, on a shoestring, which do you think they should do first? What would be the most important thing to do first? And then how much money is it going to do? If you did a trust and a will and these things you talk about, is it like a couple of thousand dollars? Is it many thousands of dollars, or how does that usually shake out?
If they only, this is always tough. So if they only do a will, you can find, I think, and all I can speak about is in the Santa Fe area, you can find an attorney that will do a simple will for you and maybe the powers of attorney for, say, $500 to $700. If you add a trust on top of it, that's probably going to add another $1,000 to $2,000 just because it's a longer document to prepare. You know, people can, most towns or larger communities have legal aid. You can go and talk with that group of people and get some ideas. They may be able to recommend an attorney. But I think if you are accumulating assets, it's worth spending money on an attorney and maybe not going out to dinner two times a week just to get your documents done correctly.
Well, if people wanted to go first class, Anne, how would they find out about you and about your organization and how they could, do you take any outside clients, or is it all pretty much internal or word of mouth?
Well, I don't have a website. It's all the referrals are word of mouth, but I work with people globally. So in today's world with Zoom and phone calls and things like that, it's easy for me to work with anybody anywhere. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I just wanted you to help. I just wanted to help you people find out more about you. If you even want people to any, if you're, I'm not, you're not doing this for clients, but if people want to know more, is there a way that they can get in touch with you and maybe even hire you, or are you even doing that? Is that something that you even do?
Yeah, no, I would certainly be willing to talk to people. I think if you can put my email address and phone number, that would be the best way for people to contact me.
Fantastic.
I would like to be first on the appointment book.
Hey, wait a minute.
And I will say that the first half hour I do at no charge, just because half an hour should generally give me and hopefully the prospect the ability to see if it's a comfortable relationship. And if I can't get comfortable with somebody, they can't get comfortable with me in 30 minutes, then it's not going to work well, because it will be too hard to have the intimate conversations that you need to have.
Right. That makes
and
sense.
I assume everything's confidential. I'm assuming that everything people tell you, it's all under strict confidential and there's confidentiality.
Absolutely. And it, you know, even between spouses, and unless they give me permission to talk to one another, it just is with whomever signs the contract.
I definitely want your phone number. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. I'm telling Lori.
Wait a minute. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. She'll watch back. She'll know I'm joking.
That's right. One other thing is, you had asked about resources, Corey, I think.
Yeah.
I don't have any ideas on places where you can go online to get any help. I think a lot of what I see online is either so general that it's not very helpful, or so detailed that it's not very helpful.
Right.
You know, I think you can go to an attorney, you can talk with financial advisors. If you've got a brokerage account, they tend to have to be very well versed in a lot of this stuff, and they can at least help you know where to start.
Right.
But I always ask people to think and look inside themselves to try to be able to put into words what they really want to have done with their assets. Not what everybody says you should do. What is important in people's hearts? And that can be hard.
Yeah, absolutely. Indeed. So I know we talked about the gifting. I'm just thinking, in all the things we're covering, is there any other area where there's a tax benefit? Because we want to keep government and courts out of our personal business as much as possible. And I don't know if there's any of the stuff we've talked about that might provide additional tax benefit.
Well, the idea of an irrevocable trust, where you fund it with assets and you live for more than 3 years from the date that the trust was funded, that shifts money out of your estate. So for people of high net worth, that works well and gets it to, you know, the beneficiary in a trust instrument. Corey, I keep my mind going blank. You know, I think if people have charitable inclinations, that's one way of reducing the size of your estate. There are charitable trusts where you can give a chunk of money to a charity and they'll pay you back an annuity on an annuity basis. And then after a period of years, the charity gets the pot of money. And that can all be set up through trust documents and takes the taxation out of it.
If you have art, for example, you can donate that to the local museum for a period of time and get tax benefits from that as well. So there's a financial advisor would probably be a good person because they would know all those like angles and stuff that you could, not that they're angles, not that they're not illegal. That's 100% illegal to take your art and donate to the museum and then do a write-off on it every year. Things like that.
Yep. I'm working with a very large estate right now, and they have a beautiful collection of Native American art. And that's what we're in the process of doing, is contacting museums to make some arrangement before the people, not in state, it's a trust, before the people pass away, so they can continue to enjoy the art in their home, but it will go to the museums at their death. So
fantastic stuff. Well, I don't know if we could fit much more of that great information into an hour here. That was excellent.
No, that was good.
Corey, is there anything that you want to bring up or say before we start, go ahead and winding things down here?
Gosh, I think we covered all of my questions I wrote down. I feel like that went so fast.
It did go fast. And is there anything that, because we're certainly not experts, is there anything that we missed on or anything that you can think of that we should have got out there, or maybe a question that we didn't ask you that you thought we should have before we go ahead and wind things down?
I can't think of any specific question. I just think the mantra in my mind is, look at what your documents say on a regular basis, because things change. And if you want to make sure that they're up to date, You know, I would even say look at them once a year. And if they're in great shape, fine. But
If you make large accusations, if you buy a house within that year, you want to, I mean, after 4 months, you want to, yeah, right.
That's right. It can't hurt you.
I just thought of one question that could be really silly. So let's say you do work with an attorney and they help you set up all the documents and you now get them filed with the various institutions and you've got your copies. And then all of a sudden that attorney retires or passes away. And now the following year you have something to update. Because I know that their name actually goes on some of these documents, does it not?
Correct.
So in handling something like that, now do you seek out a new attorney? Do you have to redo documents and get the new signatures, or how does that work?
You do not need to get new signatures. And until you need to have an attorney review them, you don't have to do anything.
Okay.
My recommendation is if you know that your attorney is either retiring or has passed away, if they're in a firm, go back to the firm and see if there are other estate planning attorneys that could take over your file. If it was a solo practitioner, then I would recommend you find another attorney just to connect and have a relationship.
Okay.
Last thing you want to do when there's a need, you know, a fairly urgent need, is then have to be looking for somebody to step in and help you out legally.
Right.
That's why you want to do like your funeral planning before you pass away, because they hammer you when you wait, because it's like an airline. You get the flight the same day, you're going to get crushed. If you do it like 3 or 4 weeks beforehand, you're going to get a much better deal. And it's kind of similar with that type of stuff, is it not?
Yep, that's exactly right. And, you know, we didn't talk about cremation authorizations. In a lot of states, if you want to be cremated, the best way of doing it is to have the attorney do a one-page document stating, I wish to be cremated at my death. In many states, if I died in New Mexico without a cremation authority, and you know, if I wanted to be cremated but didn't have the document, they would have to go to my children to get their permission to have me cremated. And that can be a really tough thing emotionally.
What if you didn't have children? Then what happens with you?
Then they go to siblings, I think it is. And if there aren't any children or siblings, I've done it as the executor.
Okay.
If you got none of that, they're just throwing in a blender. I'm just kidding.
But bottom line, if you want to be cremated, have that document in place.
Right.
Well, you know, the more you can do when it's under your control, or I can get done when it's under my control, then the better it will be and the easier it will be for my heirs. And it will be just the way I want it, and they won't be left with as many messes.
That's right.
And you'll have to analyze your relationship with your heirs and decide whether you want them to be saddled with that stuff or not. Anyway, great stuff. Ann Christensen, boy, I tell you, what a sharp mind you have. You know a lot of stuff, and we really appreciate you imparting some of that wisdom on us here today.
This of course, helped.
Yeah, well, I think it's going to be great.
That folks, was a big help. Thank you so much.
And this is just going to be the conclusion of another solution series episode, folks. And again, if you're just maybe as a clip, just go to solari.com or coreysdigs.com and click on the banner there for the solution series, and you can join all the great guests that we've had here and all the great information, and we'll be delighted to have you. Anything else you need to cover before we go ahead and close out the show, ladies?
Just thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Thank you for being here. It's fantastic.
It is. Good. Okay, folks, we're going to go ahead and end the broadcast. And I want to say thanks to my guest, Ann Christensen, and of course, my co-host, as always, Corey Lynn. Please check out what we got going on over at the Solution Series on Corey Lynn, CoreysDigs.com or Solari.com. Until next time, this is James White for the Solution Series, saying bye now.